Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes. The Honorable Health Court, 5th District, State of Illinois, Sound Section. Please be seated.
Good morning, counsel. Our first case today, 523-1148, People v. Chambers. And we have the appellant on Zoom, Mr. Bendick, correct?
Yes.
Counsel for the appellant. And Ms. Ray on behalf of the appellate, correct?
Correct, Your
Honor. All right, counsel, you ready to proceed?
Yes. May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, my name is Joseph Bendick, and I represent Danville Chambers. Court should remand Chambers' case in the second stage post-conviction proceedings with the appointment of counsel, where his pro se post-conviction petition presented a constitutional claim with an arguable basis in fact and in law that direct appeal counsel provided ineffective assistance. Chambers' claim is predicated on two areas of on-the-record ineffective assistance by trial counsel that direct appeal counsel should have but did not raise. First, trial counsel provided ineffective assistance by failing to assert defense of dwelling and request that the jury be instructed on that affirmative defense where the trial evidence met the slight evidence standard for such an instruction. Second, trial counsel is ineffective by failing to elicit evidence during the trial, which she later presented at sentencing that Chambers had been shot less than a year before the incident events. Whether either or both of these constitutional claims meet the low, high, disbanded first stage petitions, certainly court erred in summarily dismissing the petition. Beginning with the defense of dwelling claim, nearly 75 years ago, our state Supreme Court held that as a matter of history that defense of habitation has been the most favored branch of self-defense from the earliest times dating back to English common law. Thus, it should come as no surprise that our Supreme Court at the dawn of the 20th century firmly held that a person in defending their dwelling may resist force with force and oppose an unlawful entry against their will by one who in a violent manner attempts to enter with purpose of assaulting or offering violence to them, even to the extent of taking life, although the circumstances may not be such as to justify a belief that there was actual peril or life of a great bodily harm. That last part from our Supreme Court is vitally crucial to this appeal as to whether or not Chambers' jury believed his justified use of force defense has little or no impact on the current claim predicated upon defense of dwelling or why trial counsel is ineffective for not raising that during the trial. This is because our legislature codified that Supreme Court language in 720 ILCS 5/7-2. Those protections are noticeably stronger than those contained in Section 7-1, the use of force of defense person provision, which requires that if deadly force is to be used, the defendant reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself or another for the commission of a forcible felony. Unlike those strictures, Section 7-2, defense of dwelling, really requires, prior to the use of deadly force, that the other person's entry, intent, or attack on the dwelling is, one, in a violent, riotous, or tumultuous manner, and that the defendant believes deadly force is necessary to prevent either an assault or offer of personal violence to him or another in the dwelling, or two, the defendant believes deadly force is necessary to prevent the commission of any type of felony in the dwelling. Part and parcel to these protections in Section 7-2 is that a defendant need not wait for the other person's entry to the dwelling to actually occur prior to using deadly force. Thus, Section 7-2 authorizes force earlier than in comparable situations. With those doctrines governing Chambers' constitutional claim, his petition made an arguable basis in fact and in law that trial counsel performed ineffectively when she failed to deploy defensive dwelling given the evidence elicited during the trial. Initially, what occurred on the night of December 30th, 2018 was not an isolated incident of decedent Renice Riley's unhinged behavior. Lynch evidence demonstrated that sometime in November or December 2018, Riley likely abused his girlfriend, Danica, pushing her into a wall in the apartment she shared with her sister, Demetria, who was Chambers' girlfriend. A few weeks later on Christmas Eve, another argument between Riley and Danica occurred that led to Riley telling Chambers, Demetria, and Danica that Riley was, quote, going to have the crib shot up. He was going to have that residence shot up. Thus, it is unsurprising, about a week later on the night of the incident, Riley's actions turned violent, riotous, and tumultuous. As Chambers and Demetria were in the apartment and discussed their plans after another incident involving Danica and Danica's sister, Riley arrived at the apartment building. Upon his arrival, Riley began yelling and screaming obscenities and physically threatening Chambers upstairs in the apartment, while at the same time, Riley banged on the building's security gate, attempting to violently and riotously enter it. This disturbed Danica so much that she ran downstairs to stop Riley from threatening Chambers and to calm him down. Danica admitted that Riley was so hostile that she had her arms around his neck trying to keep Riley downstairs while he was inside the building's security gate. Demetria and Chambers thereafter came downstairs to the building's common lobby by the security gate. Chambers testified that they made this decision because he believed Riley would make it upstairs and Chambers and Demetria would be stuck inside their apartment.
Counsel, if I may.
When Chambers and Demetria were downstairs.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you for a moment. So Riley, is there any evidence that Riley ever got through the security gate?
Yes, that was, so what I just described when Danica had her arms around the neck of Riley while he was so hostile, he was inside the security gate at that point, yes.
And how close did he actually get to the front door of the building?
You know, if you take a look at the exhibits in the case, Your Honor, there's that where that security gate is, and there's like a common stairwell, you know, these big apartment buildings, and then basically a few steps from there is where the door is at. It's from what the exhibits we can tell.
Okay. And the defendant in this case testified that Riley was yelling for him to come outside and indicated that he would catch him in the streets, and then the defendant came downstairs and actually pushed through this gate toward Riley, and then this fight ensues outside of the gate. Is that correct, actually?
It's not correct in the order there, Your Honor. The threat about catching the street was once everyone was already downstairs. There was a lot of profanity and threats upstairs. It wasn't specifically I'm going to do X, Y, Z upstairs. But it was enough that it caused Danica to rush downstairs, grab a hold of Riley by his neck, and, you know, physically restrain him. Now, once Demetria and Chambers were downstairs, there was this comment about, well, I'm not going to get you now, I'll get you later, basically. And also, however, Riley then stated, I'm going to quote, and this is at 966 of Chambers' testimony, quote, I'm going to catch your bitch ass at the gate. When he said that, he brandished a firearm and he was right there, so I could see the firearm clearly. Based on that trial evidence, and then thereafter, then Chambers approaches Riley just outside the security gate. Riley throws the first punch, and then during that fight, Chambers gains control of the firearm and eventually shoots a single time. So based on all that trial evidence, trial counsel was ineffective for not deploying defensive dwelling where Riley's actions were, of course, violent and riotous and tumultuous, and where the trial evidence satisfied that slight evidence standard for instructions. This would have also met the second aspect of defensive dwelling as to committing a felony within the dwelling. Also would have supported Chambers' subjective belief. Even if this didn't end up getting a not guilty on first degree, this would have supported his subjective belief for unreasonable defensive dwelling, which would result in second degree murder. Thus, under any theory available here, trial counsel was ineffective for not raising this defense. This was not like we're just going to go on sufficiency. No, they were raising, justified use of force. There's no reason not to apply this defense, at least based on the record we have now. Maybe something comes out of the evidentiary hearing via trial counsel discussions with Chambers that would undercut this all, but right now we need an evidentiary hearing on this issue. If I may turn to the second part of the claim quickly, Your Honors.
You may.
Trial counsel also performed ineffectively by not listing from Chambers during his trial testimony the effect of being a prior shooting victim it had on Chambers' actions in December of 2018. The direct appeal record shows Chambers had been shot in the lower back in March 2018 and that the bullet remained inside Chambers. Chambers appeared in his post-conviction petition that he provided these medical records of the primary shooting to trial counsel before trial. People v. Miller, the 2014 First District Appellate case, demonstrates the petitioner makes an arguable claim of ineffective assistance in such situations. Miller, the prior shooting occurred 7 years prior to the charged case, and the claim of Miller had such merit that the state state there only contested a procedural bar, which the appellate court turned aside. Where a defendant's perception of danger is always material and relevant, Chambers' trial counsel provided arguably ineffective assistance by not eliciting the March 2018 prior shooting and its effect on Chambers, and it would have also supported the second-degree murder, lesser mitigated offense. Assuming the instant claims were above record on direct appeal, the state has not contested that, then direct appeal counsels arguably provided ineffective assistance by not raising them, or either or both show that trial counsel is, or direct appeal counsel is ineffective, the result is the same. This court should remand the Chambers of petitions for second stage proceedings with the appointment of counsel. And if Your Honor, I have no further questions.
Justice Fine, any questions?
No questions.
Justice Hackett, any questions?
May I ask a clarification, please? The thrust of your argument on this second point is the effect of the previous shooting on the perception, subjective perception of the defendant, correct? Is that what the thrust of the argument is?
It's both subjective. It would for sure go to subjective. You know, what Chambers is prior shooting and being victim 9 months prior, of course, would affect subjective. It would also affect the jury's determination of what an objective person, because you also take for an objective where that person stood on the day that the actions occurred. And so this would affect the jury's determination of what an objective person in the same situation would have done.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel for the appellee, Ms. Gray, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Becky Ray, arguing for the people. In my argument today, I'd like to explain why trial counsel was not ineffective for not raising the affirmative defense of defensive dwelling. I'll stand on the arguments in the state's brief for the other sub-issues unless the court has specific questions about those. Quite simply, the affirmative defense of defensive dwelling was not a meritorious defense. Defensive dwelling requires a reasonable belief that defendant's conduct was necessary to prevent or terminate another's unlawful entry into or attack upon a dwelling. Riley, the victim, was not attempting to enter the dwelling. He was banging on the gate and yelling, sure, trying to entice the defendant to exit the apartment, the dwelling, and fight him. To that extent, the victim was successful. Defendant did exit the apartment, the dwelling. At that point, there was no entry into a dwelling to prevent because the parties were not inside the apartment any longer.
Counsel, did Riley ever get through the gate?
No, Your Honor.
I didn't see where that was in the record. Okay,
thank you. And I can tell you where that is in the record. It is at R1, which is Danica's interview. And she also says, the transcript there is, I think, exhibit, if I can find it, 197, I believe, is where that is, E197, where she says that he never stepped foot inside the gate, even when she had the gate open. And I think there's disagreement between the state as to her actions in putting her arm around Riley when she had that gate open. She was whispering in his ear. She wasn't telling him, she wasn't physically restraining him. She was telling him to calm down. And that is also in the record as well. I can't lay hands on that at the moment, but if the court would like, I will get that information for you. But there's some disagreement about what her actions were, and I think it's clear that with the gate open, had Riley ever intended to enter the dwelling violently or otherwise, that would have been his opportunity. Yet he never stepped foot inside the gate, according to Danica's interview, which occurred within hours of his death. So again, there was no entry into a dwelling to prevent at that point because all the parties were outside of the dwelling in, as counsel put it, the common stairwell vestibule area of the apartment building. And defendant did more than just exit the building. He approached the gate. He forcefully exited the gate, so forcefully, in fact, that the gate hit the victim in the face, knocked him back a couple of steps, and allegedly knocked a gun that only defendant saw from his hand. That gate had been being held closed by Danica, not to keep Riley out, because as the testimony is clear from trial, that gate locked itself when it was closed. You could only get in with a key. Defendant's testimony even established that. Danica was holding the gate closed from the defendant, who tried not once, not twice, but three times to push through that gate. And when he was finally successful, the tussle occurred outside the gates. The murder occurred outside the gates because defendant exited the gate.
Counsel, how much time elapsed in the record? Is this actually undisputed? How much time elapsed between the time the defendant exited the gate until the shooting, roughly?
From the testimony, I believe it was mere minutes. From the time defendant exited the gate, it's my understanding that Riley punched him immediately and defendant reciprocated in that respect. There was some testimony that defendant initially went to his vehicle first, but there's conflicting testimony on that. Some said the fight ensued right away and that he didn't go to his vehicle first. So I believe it was just a matter of minutes that this occurred. Defendant's own testimony even confirms that Riley was not even trying to enter the gate. And the gate is on the first floor. The dwelling, their apartment, was on the second floor. So not only was Riley not even trying to enter the gate, he was not even close to entering the dwelling. So there was no dwelling to protect. And it wasn't Riley who was trying to get Danica to remove her hand from the gate. It was the defendant and Demetia, Danica's sister. And that citation I gave, the E-197, was correct, that Riley never entered the gate. So there was no entry or no even attempt to enter. There was a loud ruckus, and some could characterize it as hostile, and there were some profanities, but that doesn't make the banging on the gate or the yelling violent or riotous or tumultuous. And if that is the case, there was still no entry, again. And defendant asserts that this is a textbook case for defensive dwelling, and in his brief he cites the home invasion statute as an example supporting his claim that defensive dwelling should have been raised as a defense. But the home invasion requires an unauthorized entry. We don't have that here because Danica invited Riley to the apartment. There is evidence, also I think it's at E-193 and 4, that she couldn't sleep because of the ensuing argument that had occurred in the apartment between the defendant and her sister and Riley's sister earlier in the evening. And so she wanted to pack up and leave, and she called Riley to come and help her pack up. As a resident in that home, in that dwelling, she invited him there. So even if he had entered, again, no evidence that he did or even tried to, it would have been an authorized entry, not an unauthorized entry. So it doesn't meet the home invasion statute, which defendant cites in his brief. And also, home invasion requires the person trying to enter to know that there are other persons present. Again, they weren't present in the dwelling. There was no one present in the dwelling. They were all outside the dwelling. Uses force or threatens imminent use of force is also required for home invasion. Defendant didn't force his way open, not even when the gate was open. The threats of force were for future harm. The statute requires imminent harm. The victim had resigned himself to the fact that he wasn't going to harm defendant then. Defendant even said the victim, quote, realized he wasn't going to be able to bait me outside, and end quote, and he'd catch him later in the streets.
So no imminent harm. And there's a part of the home invasion statute which defendant has left out of his quotation, his citation to that statute. And it is, quote, and personally discharges a firearm. Defendant didn't include that in the home invasion statute he cited. And the only person who saw, allegedly saw Riley with the firearm was the defendant. The uninterested witnesses, Hortensia Morales and West, neither of them saw Riley with a weapon. But Morales did see the defendant raise his right arm, reach his right side and raise his right arm, and he had the gun. The only person who personally discharged a firearm that night was defendant. And that was to murder the victim, who wasn't violently, tumultuously, or riotously trying to enter any dwelling. Defendant also asserts that Riley threatened to commit aggravated battery on defendant, but he doesn't cite the specific subsection. Regardless, none of those sections of the aggravated battery statute would apply here, and defendant, even in his opening argument, didn't cite to which section of the aggravated battery statute that Riley would supposedly be violating if he were to enter the apartment. Essentially, the record rebuts that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this allegedly affirmative defense. Neither the facts nor the law support this defense in this case. And trial counsel is not required to raise non-meritorious issues to be effective, and appellate counsel is not required to raise every conceivable issue. And this is especially true when the issues that the defendant alleged trial counsel should have raised had no merit in the trial court. And that's exactly the situation here. The trial court did not commit error in dismissing the defendant's pro se post-conviction at the first stage because his petition was frivolous and patently without merit. And for all the reasons argued here and in our brief, we ask this court affirm the trial court's dismissal. Thank you.
Justice Ryan, any questions?
The gun was found, there was a gun found under the victim's body.
Yes.
There's no evidence in the record linking that gun to any person, only the testimony of West that they saw the defendant hovering over the body for a few seconds after the shooting. Is that right?
That is correct, that West saw the defendant lean over the body for 3 or 4 seconds. It's undisputed that defendant had that weapon. He even said so himself. He said that he basically disarmed the victim, Riley, when he hit him with the gate, and that he picked up the gun. And while he was fist fighting with Riley, continued to hold on to that gun, which is incredulous testimony. There was a stipulation that that weapon was the murder weapon. However, I don't believe there was anything linking that gun to anyone specifically, although they did find weapons and ammunition in Demetia and Danica's apartment, covered in men's clothing. They also found it at the defendant's parents' home. They found some ammunition, which matched the same caliber as that used in the firearm that killed Riley.
Thank you.
Justice Hackett, any questions?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
And Mr. Bendick, you'll have an opportunity to address us in rebuttal. You may proceed. And you're muted, Counsel.
I apologize, still muted there. Just a few comments in rebuttal, Your Honor. The state makes a lot of focus of their defensive dwelling argument on that Riley either never got up to the front to the apartment's door, or never got into the apartment's door, but it's been over 50 years since the Illinois Supreme Court stated that the right extends beyond the threshold of the dwelling. And I think the state's argument just highlights why an evidentiary hearing after trial counsel's decision or lack thereof here is necessary, because there are some facts as the state is eliciting. Does that right extend in a common area where you have a right to be at, if it's your dwelling, down towards the security gate? To respond to the state's argument that Riley was never inside the gate, that's not my reading of the testimony on pages 639 and 640 of the current record, and then Exhibit R1, which is Danica's videotaped statement hours after the incident. This court can look at that. The state ignores Riley's threat at the security gate. Quote, again, I'm going to catch your bitch ass at the gate. And when he said that, he brandished a firearm, and he was right there so I could see the firearm clearly. Whether that is, you know, the jury ultimately ends up believing Chambers' testimony on this, that is an issue for the trier of fact only. We do not, for slight evidence standard, determine whether that was credible or not. This should have been presented to the jury at the defense dwelling. And the state also ignores the Lynch evidence here and its impact on defense dwelling. You know, specifically, Riley threatening to shoot up the apartment just a week before the incident. And he has a gun, according to Chambers' testimony. Defensive dwelling, of course, should have been raised here by trial counsel. It was deficient performance by trial counsel not to present this to the jury. There was slight evidence that the trial court would have erred if it had denied an instruction on defensive dwelling based on what was presented during the trial. And it is at least arguable at this stage that Chambers was prejudiced by that deficient performance, because either it would have been a not guilty verdict or a finding on the lesser mitigated offense of second degree murder for defense of wealth. And if your honors have no further questions, in fact, just a point as to one last point as to this threshold and where defense dwelling can be executed at. The Smallwood case points out you don't have to have an actual entry into that house. If the people are outside, you can still use deadly force. And that's been the state of our case law for over half a century. So the state's just wrong on that aspect. And if your honors have no further questions on this issue or the sentencing issue, we ask for the relief request in the briefs, and we thank you for your time. And also, I want to thank counsel for not opposing my motion to do this argument remotely, and thank your honors for granting that motion. It's much appreciated.
Any questions, Justice Vaughn?
No questions.
Justice Hackett?
No, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel. We will take this matter under advisement and issue a decision in order in due course. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
We will be in recess for a few minutes while we set up the next Zoom.